Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for August the 19th, 2018. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take a look at City Hall, the State House, all the way out to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, my week's off to a great start because I'm back in Chicago after spending the last week down at the Illinois State Fair, my beloved State Fair. I will say at least it wasn't the 90 degrees with 90% humidity this time.
It was a little more tolerable.
A little, well, yeah. I wouldn't go that far. It was more temperate, but yeah, it was a couple of long days. You had Republican Day, Democrat Day. I knew I was back in Chicago yesterday. I went out. A friend graciously offered me a chance to be out on the boat yesterday for the Air and Water Show, and picked up the boat up at Belmont Harbor, and they have a little like cafe there. And there was a guy in front of
That's
me.
That's a very nice harbor.
Guy in front of me asked the woman behind the counter, "What's in a lemon shake-up?" And I thought, I just left 8,000 lemon shake-up stands down in Springfield at the State Fair. I visited the pork patio, though, as always, one of my favorite stops, and had the butterfly pork chop sandwich with a little extra seasoning and some barbecue sauce.
You didn't have a horseshoe?
You don't eat a horseshoe at the fair.
Well,
no.
You were in Springfield, though.
No. I mean, you know, but see, that's kind of the attitude people have about Chicago. Everybody thinks, well, all we do is eat
pizza,
deep dish pizza,
and Billy Goat burgers.
Yeah. No, it's a horseshoe is kind of a winter comfort food, I think.
Okay, all right.
And for the uninitiated, that's a piece of toast, a Texas toast preferred, with an open face sandwich. Then you've got the ladled cheese sauce over the top, and then you throw the french fries down on top of it, and a little Worcestershire sauce over the top of it. I like that, and a little couple of drops of Tabasco. Grilled pork tenderloin is the way to go, just in case you're wondering. But it's a classic staple of Springfield. But yeah, that's kind of a winter dish, not summer.
You know, they have it on the menu at the Guaranteed Rate Field, and it's a pretty good one too. It's a burger patty, though.
Yeah, and that's the common way is with the burger, but you can do it with any kind of meat. There actually, for a time, someone tried a vegetarian version, which doesn't quite cut it.
Not quite going to work.
No, it doesn't make much sense. But one thing that I had my colleague Bill Ruthart was down, who covers city politics, and at the pork patio, and they had a I know you're big on food on a stick, guys. This was pork tenderloin on a stick wrapped with bacon.
Ooh,
yeah, it wow. was that was that hit the spot. All right,
that would do it.
Yes, that would do
anything
it.
Wrapped in bacon hits the spot.
I'm not sure your deep fried Twinkie wrapped in bacon would work.
Yeah, it might work.
Oh, gee, man,
got to be in the right frame of mind,
or out of your mind. I mean,
exactly.
Whoa, but no, that was very good. Excellent. And like I said, the weather held a little bit, so that was kind of nice. Although Wednesday night, and apparently they've been getting this phenomenon more and more in Springfield of these flash kind of thunder showers, and it it looked like heat lightning in the sky, which I understand people said the same thing up here in Chicago, that it would look Wednesday night. It looked like heat, you know, the old heat lightning. But boy, it unloaded down in Springfield, and like 2 inches of rain in no time.
Wow. Could have used that here.
They shut down the entertainment on the grandstand, and people were kind of wading through water through one of these tunnels to get to the infield parking area, and they had shut that down the next day. That's how much rain had fallen. And you know, when you get these dry spells, it doesn't soak in, it just, you know, spreads out. So kind of fortunately was able to evade most of that. But anyway, back from the state fair.
Well, one other question here.
Yes. Okay. Sure.
Change topic here. Evidently, you did not make it to the hog calling contest.
And actually, what I found out, Dave, I thought it was today.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually last weekend.
Oh, it was last weekend.
So you should be able. You should be able to search for some tape.
Some. All right. And I'll see if I can come up with something.
Oh, please feel.
Yeah.
Please feel free to jump right in when you get.
I'm sure you're anxious to hear it.
It's okay. I heard enough squealing from the politicians. So it's. In fact, Wednesday, as I said, Republican Day, it had actually been forecast to rain all day, and it did not rain at all until that night. But a couple of the candidates and politicians came out to the fairgrounds wearing, like, boots, you know, good rain boots.
Yeah.
And I told one of them that they felt kind of embarrassed because they were wearing these boots. And I said, I can't think of a more appropriate place than in a crowd of politicians to be wearing boots.
And the higher the boots, the better.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Especially when you're so close to the various barns over there. But anyway, it was good. It's good to be back home. Always good to be back home. But yeah, Air and Water Show continues today. I can imagine there's some pretty good views out of these windows here up in the sky.
Well, we'll find out.
Studio.
It gets underway a little less than 3 hours now. So we'll see what happens. Yeah.
I mean, it's the first time I've been out in the lake to see it. And I give Dave all the credit in the world. He was in that press boat for the Mac race, and I know that the waves were huge at that. And
they were twice as bad as what you were describing earlier.
Yeah. I had no problem out on the boat, but a lot of people did, and I can understand. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, no one has to be apologetic for it. That's just the nature of being out on the lake, and I guess the conditions on the lake are supposed to be much better today than they were yesterday.
A little calmer, and it has to do a lot with the wind,
wind
direction and the speed. So, we'll see how that plays out. One thing that you did correctly, though, is you did not go below or go down underneath in the quarters, really, is to better describe that. Because if you do, and the water is rough like that, you will be in trouble.
Yeah, nobody warned me about that. One of the first times I was on the lake.
Someone should have told you.
Hey, go downstairs. We need to get some more drinks. I'm like, okay, cool. I'll go down there. And I came back up. It's like, oh, no. This is not good.
No, you don't want to be in the bulkhead. That's although, I have to say, you know, in some respects, it just reminded me of an Amtrak trip to Springfield. Things didn't rock any more than normal on that, so... What can I say? Andy, we can't keep just hitting one home run.
No.
For the Cubs here.
Well, on either side of town.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. Yes.
Same score, same result, basically, with a home run accounting for the only run. But, yeah, you got to beat Pittsburgh, especially there. That's the Cubs pretty much own that town when it comes to baseball in recent memory. And now the weird thing is that you pick up the paper today, and you see that the lead in the Central is 4 games, and it's over St. Louis, not
right,
over Milwaukee.
Though. Right, and I've been watching the Cards out of the you know, corner of my eye.
Mm-hmm.
They are hot. I mean, big series against the Nats,
mm-hmm.
and now Milwaukee. Yeah, it's Things are worth watching right now.
Yeah. What was not worth watching yesterday is another bad start by Tyler Chatwood.
Really? I mean, and when I saw Mike Montgomery went to the DL and saw Chatwood was coming in, and it was like, I think a change of scenery would really do him some good.
Yeah, that's what they thought from Colorado, too, to Chicago. And the scenery change was to the bullpen.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is where the Cubs miss Yu Darvish. This is where he would, you know, obviously he'd have been in the lineup already. He'd have been in the rotation already. But you could probably get by a lot better with a guy with some talent.
That's being honest about it. I mean, yeah.
He just had a rough go of it. I mean, I don't know if it is the change of scenery here to Wrigley Field, you know, where it's obviously a difficult place to pitch at times. No more difficult, I would imagine, than Coors Field, where you can break your bat and still hit a home run.
Yeah, but this is walks.
And it's weird, too, because if you give up walks at Coors Field, it's not so much the home runs, it's the walks and the bloop hits, because you have to play so deep, because the field is huge.
Right, right.
And they're conditioned there not to walk batters. And I don't remember him having this much issue with command. And I'm not sure what it is.
I just don't know. When I saw the pitching change, I was like, this is not going to be a good one.
No.
Bears?
Yeah, kind of exciting last night. It's a preseason game, but it's hard to kind of get too amped up about it. But you know, there were some baby steps in the offense, which is very complex. And Mitch Trubisky got a little more time out there yesterday. 9 completions and 14 attempts, 90 yards. He did throw a touchdown pass and did throw a pick. His last throw was a pick, but you could kind of tell there was something wrong with the route. And Terry Cohen kind of broke the route off a little too early and didn't make an adjustment and try to prevent the Broncos defender from actually catching the ball. The other problem with Trubisky was a fumbled snap in the end zone, which resulted in the safety. Yeah,
and I saw just almost all of the first half. That's all I was able to stay up for. And yeah, that safety was not. It's like you know, when the score was 5-0,
yeah,
it was like, okay,
you wonder what inning.
I might as well just turn on a baseball game instead. And they did go on to score a touchdown. But it was like off of a 32-yard pass interference call, which I'm going, this takes me back to the old Bears, where the biggest offensive play was pass interference.
Yeah, and you know, we also last night got to see the complexities and the what's going to be a really strange thing to watch this year is the helmet rule. And Kyle Fuller got dinged for one, and Kyle Fuller is not the one that actually lowered his head. It was the receiver that lowered his head first.
Right.
What are you supposed to do? You can't stop yourself in midair and adjust to what the receiver does. And this is going to be the nonsense of the catch rule that they tried to clarify last year and this year. This is going to be the nonsense of this whole thing too, with just bringing in this rule. And I understand that they want to make players safer, but you know, if you have players that are more tentative now, you're going to get hurt even more because you're not playing the game you're used to playing.
And the tackle was shoulder.
It was shoulder. Yeah, it was shoulder to shoulder. And it looked bad because Kyle got pushed off the pile a little bit there because of the way that he hit the guy's shoulder pads. But then they throw the flag, and you're like, what are they doing?
And, I mean, to me, that I don't know what's reviewable. I don't know what is anymore either in this sport.
Yeah, that's true.
But that to me should have been a reviewable play.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting dynamic this year too. I think there're going to be a lot of weird things, and you know, you hate to see a game.
Well, that's what's going to happen.
By it. Exactly, and that's going to be what kind of tilts the field, so to speak, in maybe reviewing how they're calling this.
Well, hopefully, you know, I know there was some talk from the announcers last night about how they want to compile some of the tape of these calls and see if they can't establish some protocols for when the actual season begins.
Yeah, it would be nice to get it rectified before they kick it off for real in September.
Yeah, but it's not pretty.
No.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy, of course, has the latest sports. Producer Cassara is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is looking for the corn dog that I left in his drawer. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline Studio on Upper Wacker Drive overlooking the Chicago River. In case you can't tell, and I sure can tell, I still have my summer cold that I picked up, which was only amplified by the state fairgrounds. But last week, the Queen of Soul is gone. Aretha Franklin will always have that title. And to honor her memory, here's a bit of her performance at President Barack Obama's 2009 inaugural. That's, of course, the great Aretha Franklin. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. What does it say when Omarosa Manigault Newman is viewed as a victim? What does it say when it's Donald Trump that makes her a victim, calling her a dog in a tweet? She's out with a tell-all book called Unhinged, and last week on Meet the Press, she told Chuck Todd she had tapes of White House conversations. Now we know perhaps 200 of them, including this one, when White House Chief of Staff General Kelly fired her, and she taped it in the Situation Room, which is, of course, against protocol.
I think it's important to understand that if we make this a friendly departure, we can all be, you know, you can look at your time here in the White House as a year of service to the nation, and then you can go on without any type of difficulty in the future relative to your reputation.
So on that same Meet the Press program, Omarosa said that those remarks by Kelly made her feel threatened.
It's very obvious a threat. He goes on to say that things can get ugly for you. The Chief of Staff of the United States, under the direction of the President of the United States, threatening me on damage to my reputation and things getting ugly for me. That's downright criminal. And if I didn't have these recordings, no one in America would believe me. No one. So I protected myself, and I'm going to tell you, I'm so glad I did. Because now we can put to bed all those false rumors that one reporter stated and the false reports that were spread around by the media.
So on Meet the Press, Omarosa continued playing the tape, saying Kelly continued to sound those warnings, especially when she said she wanted to talk to her one-time apprentice co-star, Donald Trump.
Can I ask you a couple of questions? Is the president aware of this?
Let's not go down the road. This is a non-negotiable discussion.
I don't want to negotiate. I've never had a chance to talk to you, General Kelly. Yeah, so if this is my departure, I'd like to have at least an opportunity to understand.
We can talk another time. This has to do with some pretty serious integrity violations. So I'll let it go with that. So the staff and everyone on the staff works for me, not the president.
So there you have it. I'm not sure about Omarosa having her reputation be damaged. given what we've seen in her history. But we do have the president this morning tweeting out, study the late Joseph McCarthy, because we are now in period with Mueller and his gang that make Joseph McCarthy look like a baby, exclamation point, rigged witch hunt, exclamation point. There's your news this morning from the White House. Well, we're going to switch gears and bring things a bit more local here. Joining me now on the phone is Greg Murphy. He's the regional school superintendent for Kankakee in Iroquois counties. Greg, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you, Rick.
I wanted to have you on because so much has been made about the issue of the new school aid funding formula, the fact that the legislature is pumping in and is pretty much obligated to pump in $350 million in new money each year, the effort to finally direct money to the schools that need it most, all of this being hailed as very historic, and it is, and I don't mean to take away from that. But it's also, you know, the devil's in the details, and you're on this new committee as part of this legislation to make sure that we're doing things right with evidence-based funding. What actually is that?
I think if we distill it down to its simplest terms, it causes us to look at education funding in Illinois not as how much money is there to spend on education, but instead causes us to focus on what research tells us it costs to educate young people in today's economy, and it changes the conversation.
So is it a reprioritization, or is it this works and devote stuff here, this doesn't work, we shouldn't be doing so much over here?
Let me give you an example. Class size, I think, is an easy component for us to talk about. And intuitively, I think that most people believe that smaller class sizes would be better for students to learn. Well, if you run that argument to the nth degree, then we would expect to see one-to-one ratios, one teacher per one student, and quickly realize that's not doable in a state. So you can either walk away, but instead, the evidence-based model looks at educational research nationwide, and it takes a look at questions like class size. And when you look at the research and student achievement, one of the pieces that comes out of this is that if we're in a kindergarten through third grade classroom, an optimal size is one teacher to 20 students. Whereas when we go to a fourth to a 12th grade classroom, one teacher to 25 students is that optimal size, and that those ratios really point out when you start to no longer see the increases in student achievement by decreasing class size. So it takes us away from intuition and puts us into research.
Well, just for example, with class size too, does it depend on what the actual area of academic study is with class size?
It's the research really doesn't pull it out by subject area as much as by age level. And just looking at the very young students, that's where you really see an increase in student achievement when you bring those class sizes down, but you don't have to bring them down to such small levels.
Right.
The other piece that's important is that if you're looking at students that have risk factors, such as low-income students, that they actually factor into this system, that those class sizes would be, again, smaller. So kindergarten, third grade, with low-income students, that target would move to 1 to 15, and it just gives you that added time per child so that you can bring those students up and impact student achievement.
We're speaking with Greg Murphy. He's the regional school superintendent for Kankakee and Iroquois counties, also a member of a panel looking at the implementation of the state's new school aid funding formula as it affects to evidence-based research in education. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We're speaking with Greg Murphy, regional school superintendent in Kankakee and Iroquois counties. He's part of a 27-member panel reviewing the evidence-based funding model that's going to be part of this increased school funding, as well as the revision of the state school aid formula. And, Greg, we've got a call from Sally. Sally, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hi, good morning, good morning, good morning. Look, good morning. I'm a substitute in Chicago Public Schools, and I wonder if your committee is looking at the effect that putting learning disabled students in the same classroom as learning able students. And I'm finding that trying to mainstream those students just seems to be not quite right. And because there's a lot of disruption in classrooms, you know, a lot of activities, and these students, when they're in the classroom, they're isolated, or they try to isolate them from the other students. But shouldn't they be in their own classroom, and what effect that has on the learning of other students?
All right, Sally, thank you so much for your call. Greg, I'm not sure if it's part of, if special needs students are also part of this evidence-based studying that's going on.
So not directly something that the professional review panel is looking at, but always when we're talking about students with special needs, we're focusing on that least restrictive environment for those students. And it is a management question in the classroom, but I always like to point out that many times it's not just the special needs student that is benefiting from those included situations, because the amount of empathy and service that our regular education students can experience in those settings, I think, really help us from a societal standpoint. So, but Rick, yeah, it's a little bit outside of the professional review panel's purview.
More of what you're saying is more of the more broadened educational experience for all students, including the special needs student.
Absolutely, because we know that when our students become citizens, we want them to be compassionate young adults that can understand the needs of everyone around them.
Now, I know that you're also part of a subcommittee on the Regional Safe Schools Program.
Yes.
Could you explain what that is?
So regional safe schools are programs for students that either have multiple suspensions or are expulsion eligible. So there's a subset of students in Illinois that have had issues in their home school, and we work to educate those students. Our goal really is to get those students to graduation, address their unique needs, and prepare them to be those productive citizens. But also, while they're with us in our programs, we're working to transition them back to their home school so that they can be back with their cohort of students.
How does that work? How does that transitioning work? Is it by dealing with the unique nature of whatever issues the student has and trying to work through those issues and then put them back into a mainstream education?
So the students will come to a regional safe school program for a variety of reasons that would make them eligible for our program. So when our staff are interacting with the students, they're addressing the particular actions that caused that student to come to a regional safe school. And by having those conversations, as well as having smaller academic settings with those students, what we're working to do is, one, to keep them on track for graduation so that we don't have an increased frustration from those students when they do return to their home school, but also to work through whatever the issue was. So the staff is really working two parallel lanes, one on the social-emotional needs of the child, but secondly on the academics to keep them on track for graduation.
So as far as the evidence-based task force, this would seem to be just kind of an ongoing thing because the research is always going to be updated, right?
Correct.
So
And if we're talking about the professional review panel,
right.
The legislators, I believe, were able to see that that was going to be the situation. So the professional review panel was actually a concept that was embedded within the legislation to be certain that there were educators and educational leaders that were looking at the funding system and making recommendations to the legislature for any changes or modifications that would improve the system for all students.
Are you satisfied with how this turned out as far as the rewrite of the school aid formula and as far as schools in your area?
I think it's a very good first step. The piece that we need to keep in mind is that it is a funding system, and we're implementing a new system. And yes, it's much nicer to look at student needs versus budgetary constraints. So to base it on student needs is a definite improvement. But the other is to remember that to fully fund this model in Illinois, the State Board of Education this year proposed a $13.8 billion budget just for this line item, and the legislature was able to fund $6.8 billion. So that means we're less than 50% to full implementation of this new model. So while, yes, the model is very good to allow us to understand the costs associated with educating, there's a lot of work to be done to fully fund the model.
And, of course, that's always been the issue, is the what is available. And obviously, we have this commitment from everybody that supported this of $350 million new dollars each year for the decade. But
yes.
That's not carved in stone, and we know what budgeting is like here in the state of Illinois.
Correct, and I think it really changes. We need to continue to focus on education, not just for the next 10 years, but for the next 20 years to fully implement this system within the state, and that is absolutely difficult to keep everyone's attention on one initiative for that long of a time.
Unless we get into the larger discussion about state source funding and local funding and whether the overdependence of school funding on the property taxes, trying to find that fine line of local control and alleviating the burden on property taxes, which has been the discussion in this state for decades.
Yes. Well, and you know, as well as any, the local control is so tightly held, which is how we got to a point with property tax. I think the difference is that property value no longer is a accurate measure of wealth in the state of Illinois. Our economy has changed, and we're more of a service economy at this point. And so a system dependent on property taxes disproportionately is going to advantage those districts that are property wealthy.
Every time it's like one of those puzzle pieces. You move one piece and the other piece falls over here. It's a very complicated system, that's for sure. Greg Murphy, Regional School Superintendent for Kankakee and Iroquois County, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the show that you're putting on here. So have a good day.
Thank you so much.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. You know what I've said, my feelings about the president's accusations that the media is, quote, the enemy of the people, unquote. I think it's harmful. I think it could be dangerous. It's also being repudiated by the United States Senate in a resolution in Washington, D.C. Here's Hawaii Democratic Senator Brian Schatz.
We swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, including its First Amendment, which says in part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And so we can't let statements by the president declaring that the press is the enemy of the people go unchallenged. Now, both parties complain about the media, but who could argue with Thomas Jefferson, who wrote that our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost? Or James Madison, who said that the freedom of the press is one of the greatest bulwarks of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic governments. Or President Reagan, who said that freedom of the press is one of our most important freedoms and also one of our oldest. Or Justice Kennedy, who wrote that the First Amendment is often inconvenient, but that is beside the point. Inconvenience does not absolve the government of its obligation to tolerate speech. These words of past leaders should inspire us to act, to send a message that we support the First Amendment and we support the freedom of the press.
That's Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii on a Senate resolution to affirm that the press is not the enemy of the people. Well, joining me now on the phone is Doug House. Doug is the chairman of the Rock Island County Democratic Organization. He also heads the Illinois County Chairs Association. Doug, thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Have you recovered from Democrat Day at the fair?
I am a little bit more every day.
Well, quite a turnout, over 3,000 people attending the county chair's annual brunch. Of course, part of the draw was supposed to be former Vice President Joe Biden. He had laryngitis, and we had the South Bend, Indiana mayor be the kind of step in for Joe Biden. I'll let you say his name because I can never pronounce it.
Buttigieg.
Buttigieg, yes, Pete Buttigieg. Yeah, Pete. He goes by Mayor Pete for that very reason. What is your takeaway from the brunch and the speeches there?
Well, I think that we had, we were able to collectively gather the Illinois Democratic Party leadership, activists, officials, all together in the Crown Plaza on the 16th, and the messages were loud and clear. You know, it was a unified party. We had everyone under that roof, and there was no division within the House. Everyone spoke from leadership. Everyone was motivated by that effort, and Pete did a great job as a stand-in, but really, he filled that room. He grew into the room himself with his speech. People didn't know him coming in, but they certainly did as they left, that he was a voice for a really the younger generation of Democrats that are coming up.
You touched on something that I touched on in our coverage of the day, was Speaker Madigan, the state party chairman, kind of opening the event by saying, basic rule in Illinois politics, the political party that remains united wins the election, which seemed to be a not-so-subtle poke in the eye at Republicans over the continued divisions that exist in the state's Republican Party that were basically symbolized by the March primary, with Governor Rauner winning renomination by 3 percentage points over Jeanne Ives, and the continued divisions among their social conservative base and this governor.
Well, I think the speaker made an extremely good point there, and I've seen it throughout my career as an activist within this party. At times when we were divided, we weren't successful. And under a unified party banner, we won and won well across the state. But, just the last election in 2014, we had some divisions in the governor's race, and those are healed. I did not sense any of that within the room, regardless of the coalition within the Democratic Party, labor, minority community, women's groups. We were all there and all working together. And, the voices were loud and clear that the importance of winning and the importance of pulling together to send a clear message both to Washington and to Springfield was certainly a dividing or a uniting factor in the glue that was pulling us all together.
Yeah, and I didn't see any real evidence of, you know, something that we talk about often, including on the national stage, too, of kind of the division between establishment, so-called establishment Democrats and the, you know, Bernie Sanders-type Democrats. I didn't see any real tension or divisions existing in that room.
Well, the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association is a coalition-building organization. And one of the very first things that we did following the 2016 general election was to try and heal those wounds and bring everything together. The recognition that Bernie Sanders was not an anomaly, that there are people out there hurting. There are young people who are underemployed, still living at home with no prospects of a decent job or a retirement, and inability to even the prospect of getting out and forming, having a family or buying a home. These are all challenges for young people, and not so much young people. This is a growing number of people into their middle age now. A lot of my son's friends who are in their early 30s are still facing a lot of these challenges. And so these are numbers that are going to continue to grow, and a presence that will continue to grow within the Democratic Party.
We're speaking
absolutely critical. Got to speak to those issues. It's absolutely critical that we try and address those.
We're speaking with Doug House, the chairman of the Rock Island County Democratic Party. He's also chair of the statewide Illinois County Chairs Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Doug House. He's chair of the Illinois County Chairs Association. He's also chairman of the Rock Island County Democrats. We're talking about the aftermath of Democrat Day down at the Illinois State Fair. And, you know, Doug, the county chairs organization has kind of taken on a more modern activist role in Democratic politics, and it doesn't hurt when the fact that the party standard bearer for governor, J.B. Pritzker, is able to provide some resources and help sprinkle the infield, as it were.
Yeah, the party has certainly benefited by his enthusiasm, but also the resources that he's brought to bear to help rebuild and re-energize our party across the state. He's expressed a genuine interest from the very beginning in the introduction of himself and his campaign that he was interested in helping to build the party, and I've evidenced that through all of his actions, including his ability to contribute or support candidates in the party.
How do you differentiate what he is doing after we kind of saw Bruce Rauner do the same thing as with his wealth to rejuvenate a Republican Party, and it, you know, the good, the pluses and the minuses with that?
Well, the way that I would describe the way that Governor Rauner approached it is that he broke the party. He broke the Republican Party. He took a large amount of money and set it in front of a fan and turned it on, and it just spread across the state Republican Party in a way that did motivate or make them enthusiastic for his candidacy, but it didn't do anything to build their party. It didn't create any infrastructure. It didn't motivate and bring out any activists and build the party through people, because that's really what the party is. It's ideals, and it's people to help to put those and to effectuate that change. Once that money's gone and once that resource is gone, I feel that he's broken the Republican Party in a way that they will learn, they will have forgotten what they had learned in terms of raising money and in terms of that grassroots infrastructure types of things they did. Conversely, what we've done through the Blue Wave movement within the state of Illinois is we've built our party. I put together a program myself through the county chairs that was a bottom-up program, talking with county chairs. What can they do? What do they need? Where can I help? but also going out and meeting with them, traveled the state extensively talking to county chairs, telling them that it was important, that they needed to continue to do the things they'd always done, knock on doors, go to the parades, keep visibility up, go out and raise money. But to look at this assistance through the 2018 cycle, not as something that was always going to be there, but something that was a value added in 2018 that could help them to build their party. How could they use a few extra dollars if they had some help? What could they do to expand their outreach, grow their membership in terms of precinct committee people who were doing that work, talking to their neighbors, knocking on doors, talking about our issues and our candidates? And that's what it's been. And then based on those suggestions or those requests from people, the county chairs within their districts, then assistance was provided to them in a way that could help them.
So it's not just flooding the infield with cash. You were actually saying, you know, if you got some extra money, what could you do with it? And try to put a definitive kind of value to it.
Exactly. Try and empower them to do the things, give them the tools that they need to do the work that they know how to do. There are activists out there that, you know, if they had just a little bit more help. And so this is opening headquarters around the state, and this is helping canvasses people do things to get the word out.
You mentioned Blue Wave Illinois, which is kind of a joint project along with Pritzker and fundraising, outside fundraising. Pritzker helped seed the movement. But, you know, when we look at downstate Illinois, and I know that I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, but, you know, there's an awful lot of red counties in this state. And is there really that belief that some of those counties can truly be flipped blue this time?
There absolutely is. As part of our effort, we recruited 79 candidates as part of our Blue Wave effort that are running across Illinois. These 79 candidates are people for county board, county-wide offices like county clerk or sheriff, the farm team, so to speak, of the legislature or of our state party organization. And many of these red counties that you see downstate have large numbers of Democratic local officials within them. They're township officials. They're municipal officials. They are county board officials and some of countywide officials as well. So we have candidates out there who have been standard bearers for us. We're trying to build on that. We've slipped some in the past. Part of it was this Trump effort, but it's been going on for a number of years. Excuse me. And we're trying to rebuild it now. Going out, working with them, providing training. The Illinois Democratic County Chairs, in 2018 alone, we held 47 election trainings. We trained over 2,000 people who are door-to-door Democratic soldiers carrying the message. We had these 79 candidates that we talked about. We held two attorney general forums in order to help better educate Democratic primary voters on who our candidates were. We developed a newsletter that's statewide that's followed by, that's shared by 15,000 people across the state, has widespread circulation that allows all of our constituencies to participate. We held two boot camps for over 200 Democratic candidates, providing them the highest level of training and best campaign management practices, sharing with them how to develop their message, how to get their campaign up and running and off the ground, how to do fundraising. So we've been really active. We created, not to compete with you, but in the evenings on Sundays, we have a Sunday soapbox where we bring in our Blue Wave candidates. This evening we'll be bringing in myself and a number of party chairs from around the state to do Facebook Live to simply talk about what's going on within our party, how are things going. We had Christian Mitchell on from the state party recently, and he shared his views as to how he was changing the Democratic Party and moving things forward. So we're very active. We're doing a lot of work out there.
Well, Doug, I'm glad I could give you kind of a little bit of a rehearsal for tonight's Facebook Live.
Thanks, Rick.
That's Doug House. He's chairman of the Rock Island County Democratic Organization, and he's also the chair of the Illinois County Chairs Association. Doug, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We just spoke to Doug House. He is the Illinois Democratic County Chairs Association chairman, and talked to him about Democrat Day at the fair. And of course, the day before, on Wednesday, it was Republican Day at the state fair, and Governor Rauner's campaign has put together a brief highlight reel of the GOP governor's performance at the agriculture director's lawn at the fairgrounds.
We're here because we're fighting for what's right and what's just and what's good and for a better future for our children and our grandchildren. Faith, family, hard work, love of God, love of country, giving back in our communities, belief in free enterprise, belief in education and choice in education, belief in a better future, that's what Republicans are all about. This one is the most important election of my lifetime. Lower taxes, more jobs, fighting corruption with term limits. That's the winning message.
And that's Governor Rauner from the Illinois State Fair. And to elaborate on what he calls that winning message, I'm happy to have State Representative Tom Demmer from Dixon on the line. He is the Deputy State House Republican Leader. Tom, thanks so much for joining me.
Good morning, Rick. Glad to talk to you.
I didn't see you at the State Fair. I'm not sure if you were there or not, but a very good turnout. And also of more of the traditional way of doing things by going out to the fairgrounds and having kind of a rally of candidates. I just had Doug House on from the Democratic County Chairs. How do Republicans counter what everybody talks about as this blue wave?
Well, look, I think you have to look at what Governor Rauner's speech was at the fair. He talked about things that are not just Republican or Democratic issues. There are a lot of Democrats in Illinois who want to see property tax relief. There's a lot of Democrats who want to see term limits. Well, a lot of Democrats who want to see a better business climate and better opportunities for Illinois families. So I think the question really comes down to, you know, not whether this is going to be some blue wave or red wave, but what are people in Illinois looking for and who's better positioned to give them a good shot going forward. And I think that's exactly what Governor Rauner talked about. He also did so in public at a rally. He spoke to the media beforehand. I mean, this is the traditional way of doing things, but it stands in contrast to sort of a managed rally that the Democrats had behind closed doors.
What is the, I mean, I know Dixon, Sterling, Rock Falls area. What is kind of the economic condition in an area like that these days, and how does that relate politically?
Well, there's a lot of agriculture industry in this area and also manufacturing. And, you know, in both of those areas, we've seen some kind of peaks and valleys. So I think what I hear a lot from people who, you know, employ folks in this area is they're looking for some better signs out of Springfield, some signs that they don't have to worry about the next tax increase coming down the pike, the sign that they don't have to worry about the state continuing to rack up unsustainable debt. These are the kind of things that if you're a business owner, you're thinking in the longer term, not just about, you know, what happens to you today or tomorrow. And, you know, over the last couple of decades, we've seen Democratic Party control the legislature that's spent way beyond our means, that's racked up debt that we'll be paying off for generations. And really, that sends the exact wrong message to people who are trying to do business here.
I know as much as the governor talks about wanting to bring the income tax rate back down. Just the mere fact, though, that we have, you know, still roughly $7 billion in unpaid bills from the budget impasse, the fact of continued problems with the growing pension debt. I mean, is this the time that it's realistic to expect that we could actually reduce the state income tax rate?
Well, the most important thing, though, there's been so much focus on what the income tax rate is, but nothing on how much economic activity we have going on in Illinois. So, yeah, if we make no changes to the state's business climate, if we just sit back and hope that jobs come to Illinois, hope that people decide to stop leaving the state, things aren't going to change. But we would be in a position to reduce the income tax rate if we make some of those changes that will bring new jobs here, that will make families move into Illinois instead of out of Illinois. That will grow the number of people who are paying taxes. That'll grow the amount of economic activity that are paying taxes, and that's what puts us in a position to reduce rates. So I think all the focus and sort of an obsessive focus on what's the rate going to be, and you hear J.B. Pritzker talking about he's running on the idea of another tax increase that would layer income tax bracket on bracket with each rate higher than the last. This is all this focus on income tax rates. What we need to look at is how much economic activity is happening here. How many people are working? What kind of jobs are we bringing in? What kind of new investments are we bringing in? And what it takes to get that done is real changes to the state's business climate.
You want to elaborate on what changes you're talking about as far as the business climate? I mean, workers' comp, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, property taxes, too, that's an ongoing issue that faces business owners. Workers' comp, I mean, that's something that the business community has been talking about for years. I mean, I don't think that we need to, it's not some magic formula. What we need to do is look at Illinois' competitiveness, compare it to other states, places where Illinois is a clear outlier, like, in the case of work comp. We need to just bring ourselves back into the norm, back into the median. That's the kind of thing that Illinois doesn't have to be the lowest cost place in the country, but we definitely need to be closer to the average.
What about as far as organized labor and those kinds of rules?
Well, there's I think a good opportunity to give communities a chance to choose those kind of rules for themselves. I mean, communities across the state, one size fits all might not apply to every community, but the fact of the matter is, if we make changes that make Illinois a more economically competitive state, we benefit everybody from organized labor to folks who are not part of a union. The more jobs in the state of Illinois, the better the climate is for everybody, the more people can benefit across the board.
Well, the reason I raise that is because, we hear the speaker respond that, these are things that, such as it's right to work for less, or these are things that would bring down the quality of life. That's the Democratic counter argument.
Oh, sure. And, they can create a little slogan here or there. But what we have on our side is looking at states who are economically successful today, states where middle-class families have good-paying jobs, they have lower tax burdens, they have better outcomes for themselves and their families. Let's look across the country and say, what's different between Illinois today and the states that are really succeeding today? We need to try different things. We can't double down on a formula that hasn't been working well for Illinois and say, just because the same Democratic leaders have been in charge for the last 40 years doesn't mean those policies have to be the same for the next 40 years.
We're speaking with State Representative Tom Demmer from Dixon, Deputy State House Republican Leader. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking to Deputy State House Republican Leader Tom Demmer from Dixon. Representative, got an inquiry on the text line about issues about, and something that's been talked about here in Chicago, about rent control in Illinois and with the gentrification of neighborhoods, that kind of thing. I'm not sure I see that as something on the horizon. I know, believe Democratic Representative Will Gazzardi has been talking about that, but it's something I don't see going on in Illinois right now.
There's been a couple of legislative proposals for that, but I think that there's quite a bit of evidence on the other side of things that says when government gets in the business of setting prices, things don't end up very well for consumers. So I think there's plenty of examples in other states where they've tried rent control and it hasn't been very successful. I'm not sure that we want to sort of exacerbate the problem by trying to have government in the business of controlling rent here in Illinois.
as we move into the more intensive part of the general election campaign season, I'm wondering, are we going to see the continued pattern of trying to link Democratic legislative candidates to Speaker Madigan? And the reason I ask that is, one, I believe the answer probably is yes, but two, just whether has that message already kind of done its job as far as obviously weakening or leading to a dislike of Mike Madigan among a good number of the general populace, but is that just kind of a retread argument at this point? Because we've heard it so many times on TV, in the mail, over and over again. Has it lost its effectiveness?
It certainly hasn't lost its effectiveness. And I think the reason is, you know, in most articles you read about Speaker Madigan, it talks about the tremendous amount of influence and control he has over legislation that, you know, ever even comes up for a vote. And, you know, I can personally attest to being a member of the House. A bill doesn't come to the floor of the House for a vote unless the Speaker allows it to. And so when you think about, you know, across the state, there's a lot of people, both Republicans and Democrats, who are frustrated with Mike Madigan's leadership, and they don't have a way of directly voting for him or not. And so the question really comes down to, if you're somebody in the state who thinks that, you know, 40 years in politics is long enough, or somebody who thinks somebody who's been Speaker of the Illinois House longer than I've been alive, that it might be time to try something new. That's why, you know, we're encouraging people to ask your local state representative candidate who they're going to vote for Speaker. This is not something that a typical Illinoisan gets to see on their ballot. And so what we have to do is have those conversations with your state representative and say, look, are you going to continue to support somebody who's, you know, been involved in a lot of these problems and issues over the last 40 years? Or is it time to maybe take a new direction in the state?
But Representative, assuming that Democrats, under their map that they drew, will control the General Assembly, both houses, even after this November election, and Madigan weren't to be there, the Democrats would still control. Would that really change anything by putting somebody new in the speakership?
Yeah, I think it would change things. And again, it comes back to, you know, over the last 30 years, there's been all these, you know, small moves, incremental moves that have consolidated power really behind one person in Speaker Madigan. What we should see in a normal functioning legislature is the ability for any legislator, any representative to offer a bill and to get a vote on that bill. So, you know, at the end of the day, there might be bills that get defeated by, you know, a Democratic majority. But, you know, I'll give you a great example. If we look at fair maps, independent redistricting reform, this is an issue that over a million Illinoisans signed a petition asking to put that on the ballot. This is one that has broad appeal to both Republicans and Democrats. Speaker Madigan's attorney sued to block that from going on the ballot, and no bill has ever been allowed to come to the House floor for a vote. A bill like that, if it came to the House floor, would have both Republicans and Democrats supporting it. Term limits would have both Republicans and Democrats supporting it. Those bills would pass, even in a Democratic-controlled legislature. And the issue here is that those bills never get a chance to see the light of day because the Speaker has consolidated power in his own person and not gone through the typical legislative means.
I want to talk, we started out in the first segment, we were talking about income taxes, and you point about tax rates versus economic activity. But as far as reforms, too, you talked about property tax relief. And I'm kind of curious how you can have both. When I talked to the regional school superintendent in Kankakee County, and we're talking about the over-reliance on property taxes to fund local schools, and the way to alleviate that is to have the state absorb more of the costs of funding public education. It seems kind of this battle of opposites here of who can pick up the slack. If you cut property taxes for local schools, the money's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah, so I think that's, again, maybe focusing on a little bit of the wrong thing. It's just it's sort of taking for granted that all these expenses will always exist. I think there's an opportunity for us to provide meaningful property tax relief to taxpayers through government consolidation efforts and through unfunded mandate relief. Both of those are issues that have a direct impact on property taxes, and they sort of change the question. So instead of just saying, which pocket are you going to pay this out of, it says, what can we do to actually bring down the cost of government? Illinois has more units of local government than any state by far. Real consolidation across the state could save taxpayers millions of dollars, provide property tax relief. We have page after page after page, especially when you look at schools, page after page of unfunded mandates that over the last decades the legislature has seen fit to require schools to do. If we provide some relief from that, that could save a significant amount of money for local school districts. So I think it's, you know, you've got to keep an eye on both sides of that ledger, you know, not just who's paying for it, but also what can we do to try to bring down some of those costs.
Well, and you spoke about consolidation of units of government. And, of course, for decades, people have talked about consolidation of school districts. And then you get into the turf battles there over, you know, the fact that schools are very much kind of the last symbolic identity in some of these small rural areas. Although the cost savings, you know, could be very great. But you also have issues like transportation, and do you want, you know, kids traveling on a bus for 45 minutes to an hour to go to school each way?
No, absolutely. But I think that overlooks the fact that, you know, the places that consolidation makes sense aren't necessarily places that are geographically far from each other. So I think individual school districts, you know, it should be their obligation to review what the status is for them. We have some places, you know, where they're not unit school districts, so they're covering the same geographic territory, but they're split into multiple school districts. You know, some places where, you know, maybe just sharing administrators across a couple different sites might make sense and help them reduce costs. And certainly, you know, none of these issues are ever easy. You know, never changing the status quo is easy. But if we continue to pit this idea that, well, that sounds difficult, so we're not going to do it, and instead we're just going to raise taxes, I think that's sort of what got us into this problem in the first place, and certainly not something that's going to be serving the people of Illinois very well.
That's State Representative Tom Demmer, the Deputy State House Republican Leader from Dixon, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks a lot, Rick.